David Bohm Seminar, Saturday, March 21st, 1992, 5:30 afternoon session, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Right, so we were talking about the fact where we are establishing the fact, I think. And is that clear now? You know that the fact has to be established and a certain amount of thought, thinking may go into it. Also information which you regard as reliable and so on. So it's a relative thing. Although many facts are so evident that we have no real doubt about them.
What we were talking about after the break started was that maybe the issue isn't so much establishing the fact as seeing facts, or have the statement of seeing.
We have to see what is a fact, but the difficulty with fact is that appearance may be deceptive. Right?
Well, once again, we have the problem of, is there any fact in the psychological realm?
Yeah.
Physical facts, we seem to have a certain amount of coherence about. We don't have a lot, but in the psychological realm, there's a lot of things that are perceived and presented as facts that have gotten us into deep trouble.
Yes, well, I wanted to suggest that if I suggest that all thought is conditioned, then it is the conditioning, in fact, in this general sense of thought. Now, I'm saying that we can take that as a fact? Now, what makes you take it as a fact?
We can have facts about thought, but we might not have any facts in thought.
Well, then we may have facts in thought about the chair. So you see, that is thought may have. See, the question is that we need, as we said, to have an awareness so that the movement of thought is aware of itself. But in addition, this has to be put in thought so that thought has a correct fact about itself. You see, a correct knowledge about itself, right? You see, thought is very much affected by a certain kind, not only the content of what is general and universal and so on necessary, but also the thought about thought has an exceptional significance, because thought is highly affected by what you think thought is, right? Is that clear? So if you think...
Just let's go over a little bit more.
Yes, if you think, let's see how I can put it, the common view that thought is totally different from various feelings and from the state of the body and from a material process. Now that will give a certain attitude to thought, which... It may make you think that thought is a spiritual or something beyond the ordinary matter, which is in effect the same as truth, right? Which will produce too much confidence in it. So it will affect the process profoundly. So the thought about thought has a very great... So suppose for the moment thought is aware of itself in movement, but the thought about thought still comes up from the conditioning. And maybe in the next moment you find yourself back in, right? And therefore, in some way, some of these facts have to be stated so that they can enter into the content of thought, right? See, if you have an incorrect content, or even this may lead the thought that the self is the origin of thought, will have a profound effect on thought. It gives it an authority. The self is the authority behind thought, maybe the quintessence. It would give it, again, some sort of value which would be very high.
You once spoke about planting seed. And the tacit infrastructure. Planting seed.
Yes, well, yes. I think that... we have to be careful not to denigrate thought altogether, to say it's no good, to dismiss it and so on. You see that it is small in relation to the whole being, but if it doesn't go right, it will have a tremendous effect. And if it does go right, it may also have a tremendous effect. And as if we were able to think clearly about all our problems, and everything would be different.
Another type of psychological fact is could be the fact that I'm angry or I'm depressed, and if we
form yeah, yes.
an opinion about that, then we begin like it's good or bad to be angry. Mm-hmm. Then we move away from the fact immediately.
Yes, if you say you're angry or depressed, this may be a fact, and then you would have to stay with that fact. But so you may explain it superficially, and thus avoid seeing it. You see that there are all sorts of ways by which thought avoids looking at these things, and say not staying with it, but jumping off into something else is one way, or becoming insensitive is another way. You know, there are various ways. So thought has all sorts of tricks to try to prevent these things from being inquired into properly. And that's part of the reflex system. You see, we're discussing maybe, is there the unconditioned? Right? It would seem that if you said everything is conditioned, then it sort of leaves no ground. Well, maybe that's a possibility. But if you say there's a ground underlying it, then we'd have to say that that is not conditioned. You see, it would not be fundamentally changed by the experience. That would be highly connected with the issue of freedom, right? You see, if you say it's very clear that freedom to do what you like may not be freedom, because what you like to do may be conditioning. You may be conditioned to the necessity of wanting to do this, therefore you're compelled to want this, and therefore you're not free. Hmm? Yeah, but I mean, this is a tribute to the self. You may say, I need this, I want this, and I should be free to get it. Let's say, whatever it may be, some satisfaction. But you see, maybe through past experience, you got conditioned to that. So you're really the slave of the past conditioning. See, doing what you want may very often be the result, may often be quite the opposite of freedom. It gets you in, again, it gets unintended consequences. You see, you find that it doesn't give you what you expect.
Are there psychological conditioning that have the correct conditioning, that the thought in its right place?
Yes, I mean, all thought is conditioned, you see. Now, it is the conditioning. The activity of thought is the activity of the conditioning. And it's the past. It has to be conditioned. Is that clear? Now, we said that's not necessarily wrong. Provided it will, because the conditioning is limited, it cannot be universally right. You may apply it in some cases and it will work, but then cases will arise where it isn't working and where you are detecting coherence. We've discussed that, right? And you see, then when that happens, then the attitude has to be to let go of that thought. Now, we said the trouble is that we don't let go, that there is a compulsion to hold. We are conditioned to hold it, especially when the thought is regarded as essential to the identity of the self. To defend it, you see, saying that with which I'm identified has to be defended.
During the break, and something like this question of identification was coming up about, I suppose, archetypes of deity, male and female, and the power that our thought has and continues to give, and the trap that it can be. And I was thinking earlier, you talked about the king, the great I am. Really, that it seems that the king is a symbol of a father, which is a way of thinking about the importance of self. I mean, what's one sort of self is more important than another sort. And then there's the danger when women say, oh, what about a queen? You know, it's a more important female image to give us a stronger self-image or sense of identity. And it's still getting caught in the duality of thinking,
yeah,
and losing the picture of the sort of unified field.
What, yes, is it? Yeah, well, as you say, this notion of the king and the queen in the center and the supreme are archetypes. Our archetypes are essentially, would be a kind of a conditioning which might be carried in the culture and the race. You see that it's still conditioning, and some of this might be very powerful. It still is basically the same structure as the other conditioning, and anything having to do with what is universal. See, everything, anything having to do with all has the same power as the conditioning of the self. You see, if we say it's always that way and all that way. And what holds for all the world is also a very powerful concept. Right? You know, because in a way, the self is seen as the center, or the essence of all this, but what gives it importance is it's the essence of the whole, right? Does that see what I mean?
Yeah, there's this other aspect of thought too, isn't there, that knows no bounds. That always sees itself as being absolutely powerful. That if someone presents me with a problem, and I'm quick to sort of try to come up with a solution to it. But whereas if someone presented me with a 500-pound package and said, lift this up and put it on a shelf, I would know immediately that I couldn't do that without help. But give me a 500-pound problem, not immediately assume that I can do it.
Some people will. You see, if they're identified with the problem-solving ability.
It's just that the thought seems to think it doesn't know its own limits. It's like a little dog who will attack a great big dog. I mean,
yes, but you see, it's only natural. You see, that you can see the reason that if thought forms the notion of all and totality and the supreme power and so on, this will be accompanied by representations of that in the emotions and in the whole body, so that it will appear to be in touch with that, and therefore, and that's a very exhilarating sensation, which therefore there will be an automatic tendency to try to hold it, right, to continue it.
So the sort of thing we're doing now will become thoughts.
Yeah.
And what you said is that the possibility of these thoughts coming up, you know, together with or in place of.
Well, you see, if it becomes thought which is trapped in this, takes part in this system, which is trapped in avoiding the issue, seeing it in trying to prevent the acknowledgement of incoherence, then we'll be back in the same story. You know?
No. There are some thoughts that could act, that would produce movement in a more coherent way.
Well, they would help. I mean, they couldn't. See, I'm trying to say if we perceive, see if there is a perception which is thought is aware of its own movement, and that, now, and that, and that. Perception, memory is active in thought, and if we then can put it in words and put it in the content of thought, that it does work through memory, you see. Hmm? See, the two together would be important. Hmm? Because if the words still say the same old thing, we're liable to go back. Because these words have general significance. See, the statements of thought about itself, which have general significance, or thoughts will have great power. Right? The thought that the statement or the notion that thought comes from the self is in control of thought, will have a tremendous effect on how thought proceeds.
And then only immediate effect, or also right, like positive conditioning, we can call it.
We'll have it. Yeah, go ahead.
Is it only immediate effect or also?
Well, no, because it's been in the memory, so it should be respond again and again, and it will draw more conditioning to itself, connect it, associate to many other things, so that one thing will lead to another, and come back. If you see what I mean. You see.
Sorry.
Well, that was really all I had to say.
What I want to ask is, isn't there a way to not have it go into memory and therefore reemerge always in terms of the pattern of memory? Is there a way, if you see something that really, say, the fallibility of thought, that the quality of seeing that, you can have that same pristine perception again and not say, oh yes, it is this, I've learnt that. Mm-hmm. In other words, the original perception can occur again when you put your mind in the same direction. And that the fact that we immediately translate it into an idea and it's stored in my head, and we come back to it in terms of the image in the head, not the pristine inside perception, whatever you want to call it.
That would be like a state, being in a state of attention.
Yes.
Whereas if we incorporate what we hear here as an idea, then we're still operating mechanically. It's just a different reflex. We've changed one reflex for another.
But, I mean, I generally would talk this way, but just to investigate it a bit, are we saying perhaps also that there may be some value for thoughts, mm-hmm. you know, some thinking, which goes contrary to the general drift of the condition. Mm-hmm. For instance, if most people in the world thought that all human beings were part of one family, there might be a somewhat modified but better way of living than everybody is fragmented in these little nations. So that thought may have a power, not like an insight or a direct perception, but there still may be some point to thinking about these things in ways which, you know.
Is there a state of mind which could be perhaps described as question mark? You know, I think so-and-so, but look at it again, and never assume that's the way it is.
So that's
what seems to me to count. Keep looking at things.
I would call that more a disposition to all these matters. So, I mean, the danger with putting things into thought is that then the disposition is, oh, now it's a closed book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if it can be put into thought but still investigate, all right, let's look at it again, let's go into this again. I mean, if it's true, we'll find out. If it's not, then we can put it aside.
You used that little phrase this morning, that intention to attend.
Yes, an intention. Mm-hmm. So that attention to intention.
Would that be what would essentially say?
Well, I think the point is similar to the one I was saying, that no thought has a, every thought is limited, and therefore whatever we put say now, we say that, you know, it holds as far as we know, but we don't depend on it. You know, we're ready to look again.
Well, if that becomes a general thought, then
it can become. But yes, it becomes a general thought, but we have to have that thought arise out of the perception. You see, when we communicate it, it's important. There would be a tendency to slip into treating it as a reflex. But therefore, there would have to be a perception of the need to suspend the reflex and look again.
Yeah, well, in line with that, and what you said, Mary, you said if you set your mind to it, to be fresh again, it could be that one possibility is, in a sense, you're making a map of this here, and there could be two or three maps or 15 of a similar, of the same phenomenon. And it may be that using the map to be the same thing as setting your mind to it if it were held tentatively.
Mm-hmm.
And that using the map tentatively could lead to perception or contribute to it, as well as come out of it.
Yes, in fact, that would be the right way to use the map. If you're entering territory that would be partially known and partially unknown, then you would always have to use it tentatively. And you see that with the map, anyway, any map could be wrong.
Anything could become a pattern.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a map of a city, for example, if I don't have a map of a city, maybe the roads may change. No, and it may not be adequate anymore. I mean, some of them may come on way streets. Or
set your mind was wrong expression. What I think I had in mind was openness, not not a pattern to set my mind to do something, but look at things.
Yes, but the feeling when you said that wasn't so much literally what the words, but the feeling, set your mind, that is, go at it again, which seems to be correct, right?
That's what
even if it's not a pattern, but the feeling of setting your mind may be related to using thought in the way that you're describing.
Yeah, it's that, when you say there's a firm intention to do that, which is not thought, right? Which is not just the reflex.
We talk so much about the reflex, thought keeps us in a kind of trap and vice, but which is all, at least to me, it seems evident, but thought can also ask questions.
Yes.
It can can look.
Yeah, so it generally does this, well, first of all, when you face an incoherence, or secondly, it may do so out of curiosity. But then in order to ask questions seriously, you can't be holding to your thought, to the content.
About the what the brain isn't capable of doing that you mentioned earlier this morning. What the brain isn't capable of holding, or was it memory and the brain thought? The brain wasn't prepared. The brain wasn't built to do what we're asking.
Well, no, I was only saying the brain was not built to deal with a great deal of this incoherent thought.
But we don't let it go.
Yes, we don't let it go, and it builds up.
Because Lee said, well, it wasn't accumulative at that point, it was something else, didn't you, Lee? And then that confused me. Because I had thought maybe you were referring to an accumulation.
I'm getting lost. I don't remember exactly what we went through.
Right, something. But it is just a sort of like a closet stuffed full of things.
Yeah. Yeah, so they get in the way.
Oh yes, just briefly, but what I was questioning was whether or not you said the brain is not set up to handle that much thought, and I was saying, do you mean sheer volume, because it might be able to handle volume, or is it that quality of thought?
Yes.
Right.
Well, the same way the body is not set up to handle the chemicals which are produced by our industry, as you say, in a large quantity.
Or by our thoughts.
Yeah, by our thoughts, but see, small quantities can be handled.
Say that the seeing of the incoherence of the thought would be the letting go of that thought.
Yeah. Well, I think one can see that when thought is up and thinking is operating properly, that if you see that the thing is incoherent, then you can't hold it any longer.
I don't know if this would relate tangentially to this would be useful, but I can very easily get the notion that in thought, or in thinking, that I should understand something and then I should have that.
What do you mean?
That, okay, I listen very carefully, well, I shouldn't, and I get, let's say, the idea that, well, I shouldn't hold on to things too much and then I have that thought. That, it might take me a while to get this straight, but that learning, I think, happens immediately. And that, say, I'm here, attentively or not attentively, but something strikes here, there's an immediate reorganization, and then that will be operating from then on.
Yes.
And so I don't have to do anything about it.
No, if it really is a
attentive. It might be very slight, but so I don't need to be concerned about trying desperately to understand and then take it so that I can operate.
Is that what understanding is? That
right.
It's a reorganizing. In other words, there's some kind of a physiochemical change.
Yes, well, I suggested to see it. In seeing the incoherence of thought, first of all, it's like you might imagine that every time you repeat some thoughts and feelings, some chemicals accumulate in the synapses, making those circuits more and more powerful. And I would suggest that maybe a perception of incoherence, that they start to dissolve. And opens the way to a reorganization.
Could that be
a form of a definition of the word understand?
Well, that's a suggestion for what you mean by understanding. You see, the word it's open to stand under, but to find the ground of things or comprehension to hold it all together. There's a flash of understanding or a flash of insight, perhaps. Now, the insight, the moment of insight, will involve letting go. Letting go is a real physical, chemical process as well as a mental process. It clears up this smog.
We're talking about learning as opposed to acquiring more knowledge, which is an entirely different thing.
Yes, well, you see, learning is just the process. We're talking about this, learning from your mistakes, as they say, rather than defending them. Right? Mm.
So when Mary said, could we have a state of mind which is a question mark, that can be freedom from conditioning.
Yes. Yes, if this state of mind in which the conditioning is not... No, it's not automatically accepted.
Held in abeyance.
Yes, suspended or held in abeyance.
But wouldn't this state of mind be conditional in itself? Enough emotionally charged atmosphere, away from this setting.
Well, no, it would make it harder, you see. If you had that, certainly.
I'm just wondering how fundamental a change this would be.
But, yes, well, it depends on how deep the insight is, you see. Now, if the insight is very deep or powerful, then it might hold, even in the context of a great emotional disturbance. You see, there's no reason that I can see why it shouldn't. You know, that there's any limit on how it can operate. Because after all, the conditioning is just this reflex, and it is changeable.
So it might be helpful to think of the idea of the material process.
Yeah.
The distinction here, because what you do is, when you're in the mode of, you make all these thoughts and then you're carrying with you, like you build this house, and you work on building it bigger and bigger. And if you go in with a questioning mind, then you're basically releasing that and decide you're not going to keep making more bricks or whatever. And you're open to letting the old bricks erode now.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you've got to be open to that process to keep dematerializing things.
Yes. I mean, I think it's useful to think that these thoughts are a material process and involve certain accumulations of chemicals, neurochemicals, in various places. And that they're not just immaterial mental phantasms.
And the thing to do there might be to try to find that out rather than to have that as a description to see, to test that and see if that's the case, if the movement of those chemicals or whatever else may be involved with that, can that be directly discerned?
Yeah, so we've been led to question this idea that the thought is a purely mental process by various observations and chains of inference. And the question is, can we perceive this directly?
If this is so that it is material and it exists as neurochemical, and in the same way that when you have a thought that produces the feeling of fear, maybe there'd be adrenaline or some hormone like that released. Is there some thought process that would release the neurochemicals that would break down the bricks or the house or whatever?
Well, only any process. I don't think a thought process by itself would do it, because it would be already controlled by the whole setup.
So are we entering into an area that I hope doesn't get too abstract, but wondering what's the relationship between insight and a material process?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you begin to question the value of accumulating, building this house that he spoke of? At some point you start to see that it doesn't have the value you perceived it to have, that it is not providing security.
Yeah.
And that perception is an insight. It's not something based on thought, it's direct insight.
and that once you've had that insight, you would begin to question the accumulation process in its entirety, not just this particular instance.
Yes. The insight must be unconditioned. I'm suggesting the insight must come from the unconditioned, right? Whatever that is. As it cannot come from the conditioning, right? Now that suggests there is the unconditioned. At least we have to be open to that possibility. But it's implicit in a great deal of our culture that there isn't, right? You know, a lot of these things we've been talking about and thoughts about thoughts are mainly cultural. They're not due to the individual. And the insight then does change the material process.
Does it do that?
Yeah, right. Have that insight.
Well, we don't know too much about the material process, but certainly even thought changes the material process. You see, whenever you think, the material process is altered radically. See, people take these photographs of the distribution of blood in the brain when you're thinking, and as you think, the distribution of blood shifts all over the place. So the point is that everything changes this material process, that thoughts change it. And now we're suggesting that there's something deeper, more subtle than thought, something that is not conditioned by thought.
Are we saying insight is not material process?
Well, we don't know. You see, perhaps ultimately it isn't.
But
it must include a material process in the sense that it has an effect on this material process.
Could you look at this universal law that all things are energy? And so then we don't have to separate insight from thought or the material process, because it's just an energy that you're holding. It takes a certain form, and you're holding it in that, and that takes energy. And then if you let go of that, then other energies can come, and then in the form of insight, and reorder it.
Yes, well, you see, I think we have to try to explore this. And see, in various cultures, there have been different views. That one view is to say all is material, but it might be more subtle. And another view, which has been very common, is to say that there is a fundamental separation of mind and matter, a difference. Right? And it's that there is a kind of mind which is entirely in thought, right? That there's another kind which is not supposed to be. Right? See, that has been accepted. The Buddhists accept that, and it's really a part of the idealism, it's called. Well, when we say thought is not matter, that would be called idealism. But, I don't know how we're going to find out.
We have to have an insight.
Mm-hmm.
when it seems that we have adrenaline in our systems,
well,
released by insight or processes of thought, and perhaps it's necessary to question what happens with the adrenaline. I mean, if we just say, oh, this is energetic, this is exciting, this is interesting, but if we then interpret it, this is fearful, this is anger, or all sorts of other things, that's when the thought comes in and takes us down another route. But it seems to me to be quite enlightening to say, oh, this is energizing, and I don't. An accumulation of adrenaline, unused or misused, can be quite toxic. So, how do we deal with the energy in our whole systems without it leading to runaway things like violence or, you know, all sorts of stuff which we all agree we don't want to get into.
Well, I think, what were you saying?
Well, I'm really interested in the energetic level of the release of the...
Yes, well, of course, we know in neurochemicals, some of them release energy and some of them work the other way and make you more relaxed and so on. And the point is that they kind of have to be orchestrated in some way. And the orchestration has to be coherent, or, you know, rather than jangling, the nerves jangle, right?
Can we what, though? I mean, if we don't really perceive an unconditioned external reality,
no.
Then what are these neurochemicals actually relating to, except themselves?
Well, no, they relate to the whole process. You see, whether this is coherent or not may also depend on the whole context into which this activity is taking place.
You know, which is still part of the process, too. I
mean, yes.
There's no boundary in the context and the...
But I think we need... See, we have to support... we're going to suggest that there is an intelligence which is not conditioned, you see, by this process of memory. Now, it's hard to know. You see, we could say maybe there's a deeper material process. But if it's not conditioned, it suggests that in some way it's sort of infinitely subtle and so on.
Back to his point, I'm curious, is energy material?
Well, you see, according to Einstein's theory, there's an equivalence between matter and energy, that matter is a stabilized form of energy. That if the energy is sort of stabilized and moving back and forth or around, it forms something, a stable structure.
So energy could form material.
Yes, energy can form material, you see, by sort of reflecting back and forth or around and around, going stably.
So I'm looking at the concept of material, energy being, sort of material in a very fluid form, meaning that it's very unset in terms of what happens with it. And seeing thought as energy rather than material process, I'm wondering if that changes our equation in terms of, and maybe thought may be the wrong word here, maybe thinking would be more accurate, the neurochemical, the whole material structure.
Yeah, well, you see, that insofar as it depends on memory, and certainly we should look at it as a material process. Now, is...
This may be off the wall, but is material material?
Well, it depends. It is and it isn't. You see that it's the same as to say, is this circle an ellipse, or is it a circle, or is it atoms? You see that this is a matter that we have to find out a coherent way of talking. That at each stage, what was taken as an appearance is at another stage taken as the essence now.
I think all that I'm saying is when we use the word material, we wouldn't want to think too much that we knew what we meant.
No, matter may be infinite. I suggest, you see, that science will not exhaust the nature of matter. So we don't really know matter. We know some features of matter.
Well then, does our using the word material, does that mean that it's context dependent and change?
Well, certainly matter, you see, all matter is context dependent, but it may be relatively stable in various contexts.
Yeah, in that context.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like the atom is pretty stable, the nucleus, in ordinary context, but in another one it's not.
In talking about relationship of thought to intelligence, I wonder if is there any value in talking about a little bit about plasma, it seems. It seems to be a sort of intelligence.
Well, I don't know. How do you say that?
Well, the way, I don't know much about it technically, but my impression is that it seems to have a way of somehow holding together.
Yeah, well, it has a stability, but all matter has that feature of stability.
So
yeah, but it's very fluid at the same time, you see. It's a very fluid form of matter. But, I mean, I don't think you could say that it has, unless you say all matter has intelligence, that it's built up gradually. But we wouldn't ordinarily call that intelligence. It's explained by the laws of physics, you know, as due to the response of the electrons to the electric field. And now, I think we might make a distinction again between intelligence and intellect, that which we were talking about last year. See, the word intelligence is based on the Latin root interlegere or something. Legere, I don't, it means to read between or to choose between. It suggests being between the fixed, between the lines, or between being between fixed categories, you see, not being fixed on one of them or the other. Whereas intellect is the past participle, it's what has been. The intelligence then goes into the memory and becomes a response, you see. So logic may be a perception originally of intelligence, and then it becomes a rule of the intellect. And as a rule, such rules can sometimes lead to nonsense, you see. You have to be perceptive of incoherence in applying the rule.
The intellect can be a tool of the intelligence,
yes,
but it may as well be an obstacle to the intelligence, or yes, a stagnant.
It's the same as the thought process. It's part of the thought process generally, that if the intellect gets attached to all these emotional feelings of wanting to hold on and to identify, then, you see, if the categories of the intellect take on too high a value, then there will be a tendency in thought to hold them.
Is it possible for other things that we're not aware of outside of thought to affect the manner of thought? For example, I was hearing the other day of a study of people's saliva for this chemical that stimulated the immune system.
Mm.
And they tested all these people, I don't know how many, or I don't know the details of the study, but then after they viewed a film on Mother Teresa, they tested for this chemical that stimulated the immune system again, and it had increase in most of the people. And then they interviewed the people, and even the ones who felt emotionally or consciously that they weren't affected by the film, their chemical had also increased.
Yes. Well, that's the same thing we've been talking about, that the meaning of a thought will affect the whole chemistry, you know. Even if you don't believe in the meaning, it could have some effect on you, but the more you believe in it, the stronger the effect.
That would bring me back again to this, that there's some process of thought, and again, maybe I'm using thought the wrong way, that dissolves thought.
Well, it's
especially in the material dimension, I'm sorry.
Yes, it's, well, we're suggesting that thought is aware of its own movement, so it begins to, you see, thought may dissolve itself in the sense that any perception of incoherence would normally, or should properly stop that thought, huh? And it would cause you to question a look. And in simple cases where you don't have a lot of investment in it, and it does.
It's not uncommon for thought to have a thought and another thought to say, well, that's totally ridiculous, and that's the end of the process. There's nothing profound or secret about it. Quite often, seeing its own incoherence and just it's totally ridiculous. I don't know where I came up with that idea.
Yes, if you're not, if it's not attached to it, that is to say, if it doesn't play a big part in the organization of the self.
Would it be the same as not recording, having seen that it wasn't coherent? Would it be the same thing Kay's talking about?
Yes, well, I think it wouldn't record firmly. You see, if you said you wouldn't remember what happened, you know, see, I don't think that would make sense. You see, that there is a kind of recording that holds and becomes a powerful conditioning. You see, if this is taken to be very important. Now, if something happens, you may remember that it happened, but it doesn't condition you. Right?
I've heard that described as a Teflon like quality.
Oh, is that like it? What? Yes, I think maybe we should begin to think of drawing it to a close. I mean, without being too abrupt.
Do you mean non-recording could actually be the Teflon phenomenon that you would remember it, but it wouldn't have been recorded as emotional content?
Yes, it wouldn't connect up with all this emotional content and the other kind of chemical content strongly. It would be held lightly, you see.
Could you review a little bit maybe I'm just getting tired, but I'm getting a little bit lost as to why we're going into this detail about, you know, thought as a material process and electrochemical and...
Well, I think that it helps to realize that this thought is a material process and that it isn't this sort of a thing that is beyond, you see. Now, it means that perhaps we are confusing thought with something which would be intelligence or insight, and that would give it far too much importance. Now, I think it's helpful to realize all the evidence to establish this as a fact. You see, because we're establishing it as a fact by looking at all the evidence, which we get either from our experience or from people having done observations and so on.
By establishing thought as material process, does that establish it as mechanical?
Well, insofar as it's memory operating, it would be fairly mechanical. See, I don't think that memory... We're not going to say matter is all mechanical because we don't know. But memory is just that feature of matter which is mechanical. Otherwise, it wouldn't be memory. It's got a hole, right?
Memory is just that feature of matter which is mechanical.
Well, it's one of the features, anyway. There are other mechanical features, obviously. But memory is not intelligent. It repeats. It does not add any new content or doesn't perceive anything. And it responds, you see, and reacts. So that is what we might mean by mechanical. But it's imitating a machine, though it's not a machine.
Part of what we need to emphasize is not just the material nature of thought, but the fact that it's memory.
Yes. It's memory, but one of the ways of... insofar as we say that thought is not material or imply it, then we are we have made that division and have gone on the other side. Now, the first point is that it's memory, and it's basically in the same field as the memory of the computer.
Is it like a tape recording, keep repeating?
Well, it changes. It's more than a tape recording because it's open to change, you see. People have thought of, or even working on computers that might change their program in accordance with what happens. And if you had such a computer, then you would face with the problem you would need another program to decide to allow changes and so on, you see. And you couldn't really foresee all possible situations where that might become incoherent.
I mean, our memory does that.
Why?
Exactly what you described. I mean, it changes according to the surface.
Yes, that's right. It says it's conditioned. And you see, it's not a program, but it's a conditioning.
Memory will shift to satisfy what appears to be the need of the moment.
Yeah.
You say, I'm doing this because such and such happened, but that memory may not be real.
Yes, well, the memory may not be accurate.
Not accurate.
Or, and in fact, there may be a process inside we've been saying which distorts it and makes it move towards something inaccurate.
There's actually a psychotherapeutic technique around which involves changing memories.
But nothing new is happening here, really new, in the changing of the memories. Is it anything new?
Well, it's new in some sense that further memories are added, but not fundamentally new.
I keep getting the feeling that in some sense we are editing the program. I mean, in our being together here today and continuing to focus our attention on thought and on thinking, that in doing that we are somehow, as a group, learning together and editing our program. And I almost feel as if there's an intention in it that somehow this learning or this editing of the program will create a loop in thought that will eventually will create an opening, and we will eventually end up in this ground out of which thought springs. in this ground out of which thought springs, or where insight lives.
And I think that we are sort of going into this program and seeing where it's wrong, you see, where it's inaccurate and so on. And I think that is helpful to try to look at that, because this program keeps on working. Now, if we had an insight, perhaps it could all clear up. And I think in view of the fact that this insight into the whole thing, you know, has been rare, perhaps it's helpful to go into all this, you know, to see something of the nature of thought, that this conditioning, which is part of our culture, works unconsciously.
Yeah, it's like tilling the garden, you know, and then maybe an insight will spring up.
We're not saying, though, that all of our memory and our thought is bad.
No.
I almost get the feeling, because we keep talking almost at an implicit level, that it is, but I don't think you're saying
that. No, we don't mean that. You see, we do not keep on repeating that we mean this kind of memory. And we should do that, probably, but we might get a bit tired of it. There's a certain kind of memory which takes over and which distorts and which avoids perception of, it's conditioned to avoid the perception of incoherence, right?
We need memory, obviously, or we can't go forward. It's almost like the insight, we need both. We need the insight to move forward, but we need the memory to store the insight, or we wouldn't be able to use the insight.
We need memory to use insight, yes.
Right.
And memory includes not only the memory of the incidents that happened, but also some of the conditioning is needed to carry out activities. Yeah.
Is a material process, is insight a material process as well?
Well, we have to find out. That's what I was saying, that perhaps we should not try to do all this right now, because I think we're all tired.
I have a question on that point, though, one brief thing about something being non-material may act on thought. I just wonder if it matters.
Mm-hmm.
if there's something that acts in a way that has meaning and affects something that's incoherent,
mm-hmm.
at least from where we're sitting now, I don't know if it matters what it is, whether it's material or non-material.
Yeah.
It seems that that's a sidetrack. I don't mean to say it is.
It may not be.
But it seems to me that it's easy to get sidetracked.
Yeah, perhaps we should focus on whether it's conditioned or not.
Well, there's a reason. But there is a reason for emphasizing, maybe probably more than one, for emphasizing the material aspect of thought. Because as soon as you realize that, then you have available the possibility of contacting the material aspect of thought.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with looking at thought as a material process, but then positing that something that may fundamentally change thought is other than material, I don't know the virtue of that. It may be or it may not be.
Yeah, unless we had some perception of that thing, of that point.
Right, generally speaking, we don't.
Yeah, so I'd say, though, that it seems to make sense to ask if it's conditioned. See, if we said matter is infinite, it might shade off into something infinitely subtle. That's one view.
Aren't we defining everything with definitions and redefinitions and going in a circle all the time now? as we start from the beginning, defining the process,
mm-hmm.
and trying to go out of the process, redefining the process, aren't we going in a circle?
Well, we may be going in a circle. You see, that's, I think, what Lee is saying, that we should leave that point go. You see, there are places where we have to be careful of the meaning of our words. But at this stage, I don't think we're able to settle that question about material versus non-material.
Mm. Calling thought a material process as to differentiate it from energy, perhaps.
Well, no, because
energy is measured in the use of thought. There's an energy.
Well, even according to the view of physics, you see, all matter is at the same time energy. So there is no fundamental distinction, but there is a relative distinction which is useful. See, at any stage, you may say that there's fairly stable forms which we call matter. And then there's an energy.
Well, you were asked about whether insight is conditioned.
Yes. Well, that's the question we can leave everything with, I think. You see, is there the unconditioned? That's really our question. You see, if all is conditioned, whether it be material or not, then we're stuck. Now, how...
There's also, isn't it, the aspect on one hand, we can see ourselves bound by our biology. I mean, our bodies grow to a certain point, and our neurochemistry works in a particular way, and our other chemistry works in a particular way. And then we begin to deteriorate physically, and then we die.
Yeah.
At the same time, we have this thing we're calling thought and thinking and mind or whatever, which seems to be infinite, which isn't bound, or doesn't appear to us to be bound by biology.
Yes, well, thought is in some way limited by the material process.
Well, yes, but it doesn't feel that way.
Yeah, well...
It feels you can go off into the universe and do all the sorts of things that the physical, material, so-called body can't. And there seems to be a conflict there between the biological being and the tremendous potential of thought. There's two different things, which we're calling material and non-material, but which may have nothing to do with those categories.
Well, along with old age comes the question as to whether that statement is true or not. The all-powerful aspect of the brain somehow...
Sorry, but I didn't hear that.
But it still has the possibility of imagining things that the body can't do.
Well, it may be so to
begin.
With old age, you come to questions.
Yeah.
It seems like it all comes down to time. In other words, if we trace a thought through time, then it can become more of a material thing. But when we first look at a thought, it may be nothing but just a thought or more of an energy form. So it seems to have something to do with time, in my mind.
Well, maybe thought gives that power to itself, but that's not really the real thing. And itself that it can do everything, and it is infinite, and it is immortal.
Well, that's part of the illusion.
It is to deceive itself.
Yes. Well, may I suggest that it won't be profitable to pursue this question further right now.
Inside in the morning?
What?
Inside in the morning.
Yeah. As I think, the material process has certainly affected our thoughts.